give out an odor of sweat. No effortful grunt escaped any of them. For perhaps 30 minutes, they went through the staple repertory of all acrobats anywhere, though with incomparable grace and skill. And then Mohammed, the leader, took his head from his neck, and they began to juggle with that until one by one all their heads came off and went into play, so that a fountain of heads rose and fell in the arena. Yet this was only the beginning. After that, limb by limb, they dismembered themselves. Hands, feet, forearms, thighs, and ultimately torsos went into a diagrammatic multi-man whose constituents were those of them all. At times, the juggle elements composed an image like those of the many-handed Kuan Yin of the four cardinal points and the thousand arms, whose multiplication of limbs and attributes signified flashing action and infinite vigor to the ancient Chinese. But this Arab image was continually in motion. A visual synthesis of the curves and surfaces along which any single body always moved, suddenly happening all at once. And then the pièce de résistance. They began to juggle with their own eyes. The severed heads and arms and feet and navels began to juggle with 18 fringed, unblinking eyes. I would repeat to myself as I watched them the peep show proprietor's maxim. It all depends on persistence of vision. Because, of course, I could not entirely suspend my disbelief. Although, I might lay it aside for a while. I knew there was more to it than met the eye, although, in the finale, so many eyes met and greeted one's own. Such a harmonious concatenation of segments of man, studded with incomplete moons and brown pupils. And then this demonstration of juxtaposition and transposition was over. Each torso took from the common heap its due apparatus back again, and composed again his 9 complete Moroccans, they took the bows. I went to watch them whenever I could, and I haunted their tent. But I never managed to discover their secret. The chill brilliance of early spring struck a dazzle of mica from the sandstones in fillets of the mountains. They were appallingly barren, for the scanty soil could support only those plants that love dry, arid places. Spiny cacti and low-growing, warped, daisy-like things with stems wiry enough to cut your fingers. The gloomy road took us to a gloomy destination, for this city, which functioned only as a trading post, was as sullen as the perpendicular perspectives around us. We crossed an enormous bridge above a mighty river in the bleakest of valleys, and saw the town perched itself like an eagle on a precipitous outcrop of rock above the rushing torrent. This town was full of malevolent saints. Shut in on themselves in their isolation, they were an inbred mixture of Carpathian Poles and Mountain French, whose forefathers had fled Europe in the late 17th and early 18th centuries, due to persecutions of the scrupulous sects of the Reformed religion to which they belonged. There had been both Calvinists and Jansenites among them, and the town itself had finally evolved such a rigorous blend of the more mortifying aspects of both, that I was astonished they allowed a carnival there at all, for they usually entertained themselves only with hymns of the simplest melodic structure. But the high rarefied air had caused some singular mutations of their practices. After the fast of Lent, when they drank only water and ate only beans, they spent the whole of Good Friday without stirring from shuttered houses in which they brooded on the inherent evil of all mankind, and then devoted Easter week itself to exposing themselves to the temptations of the flesh, which the fair was judged to represent well enough. My cynical friend, the alligator man, was delighted to find himself defined as a siren, and took to preening himself lasciviously in his tank. To some degree, we all became more voluptuous in self-justification. But the townsfolk were kindness itself to us, and brought us all small presents of wine and cake. I soon realized that charity sprang from pity. They thought we were all hopelessly damned. The peep show proprietor industriously changed his samples daily. They were all the most outrageous tableaus of blasphemy and eroticism. Christ performing innumerable obscenities upon Mary Magdalene, St. John, and his mother. And in this holy city, I was fucked in the anus against my will, as far, that is, as I was conscious of my desires, by all 9 of the Moroccan acrobats, one after the other. Those who had caravans parked them in a paddock near the market square, usually used for grazing goats and drying linen. The booths were set up in the square itself. After we closed up for the night, the old man, who had drunk a gift of dandelion wine with his supper, nodded off to sleep by the stove, and I slipped out to watch the Arab's last performance. The day had lowered with incipient storm, and now violent winds whipped about the square, blowing the posters and bunting in all directions. It was so cold that only the intense Puritanism of the inhabitants kept them out enjoying themselves. In the acrobat's tent, the sober clothes of the customers ringed the spangled contortionists in solid shadow, and a masked conviction that they watched the devil's work weighed in the air with disapproval. The white faces arranged on the darkness in concentric circles around the ring were inexpressive as teeth in a maw, although the Arabs pelted them with a confetti of fingers and gilded fingernails. And when the last atom of flesh was retrieved from the sawdust and slotted back into place, the audience heaved a great convulsive sigh that billowed the canvas, a sigh of gratification that not one of them had succumbed to delight. They filed out in silence. Mohammed and his tinkling brethren rubbed themselves briskly with huckabuck towels and invited me to take coffee with them in their mobile home. An unexpected gesture of hospitality I attributed to an appreciation of the enthusiasm I had often expressed for their work. The storm had already risen to a tempest, and we sprinted to the van through sheets of rain. Lightning flashed, and all 9 in their Helio-Gabalian finery flared briefly like magnesium, reflecting a glare so harsh and violent, it wounded the retina. And then the rain obscured them again. A cook stove filled the van with choking warmth. Inside, the van was as soft and excessive as a horse bed, for they slept 3 apiece on 3 divans piled with satin cushions in lingerie tones, and these filled up most of the interior. The smell of sweat, liniment, and spent semen was almost overpowering. There were no windows, and one could not see the walls, for they were covered with mirrors and photographs which captured them all in every segmented attitude, so that, now stripped of their tunics down to briefs of iridescent elastic arranged upon their beds, they and their reflected or pictured parts, here a bubbled head, there a shoulder, elsewhere a knee, seemed to continue, in a subtly innovated fashion, the climax of their act. Had I not known all along it was all done with mirrors, I had never seen so many mirrors since the war began. Mohammed brewed Turkish coffee in a brass pot on the stove, and they made room for me on a pink cushion decorated with a mauve appliqued nude. The musician took off his yashmak and crouched down on a strip of white bearskin laid on what of the floor there was. He was a boy of 6 or 7, quite black, perhaps an Ethiopian. He was a eunuch. He seemed to go in a mighty fear of his protectors. He lay in an attitude of utter submission. They suggested I would be more comfortable without my shirt, and most comfortable of all without my suit, but I insisted on retaining my trousers. After that, they jabbered to themselves in Arabic for a while, and I leafed through some of the many bodybuilding magazines that littered the beds until Mohammed served us each a syrupy thimbleful of his concoction. We sipped. There was silence, and soon I became a little uncomfortable. I realized I was there for a reason, and I could hardly believe my intuition as to what that reason was. Out of sheer nervousness, I found myself complimenting them again on their virtuosity. "We are," said Mohammed, with a faint undertone of menace, "capable of virtually anything." So I could not say I was not warned. The coke rattled in the stove, and the wind buffeted the sides of the van. With a slithering movement, the castrated black boy took his flute from the pile of his discarded veils. He sat down cross-legged on a couch and began to trace on the air an angular, tritonic tune which repeated itself over and over again like a wordless incantation. The mirrors reflected not only sections of the Arabs, they reflected those reflections too, so the men were infinitely repeated everywhere I looked, and now 18 and sometimes 27, and, at one time, 36 brilliant eyes were fixed on me, with an intensity which varied according to the distance between the images of the eyes and their originals. I was surrounded by eyes. I was Saint Sebastian, stuck through with a visible barbed beam from brown, translucent eyes which spun a web of fine, shining threads on the air like strands of candified sugar. Once again, they juggled with their hypnotic eyes and used their palpable eye strings to bind me in invisible bonds. I was trapped. I could not move. I was filled with impotent rage as the wave of eyes broke over me. The pain was terrible. I was most intimately ravaged. I do not know how many times. I wept, bled, slobbered, and pleaded. But nothing would appease a rapacity as remorseless and indifferent as the storm which raged outside and now reached a nightmarish hurricane. They stretched me on my face on a counterpane of pale, orange artificial silk, and took it in turns to pin down my arms and legs. I ceased to count my penetrations, but I think each one bugged me at least twice. They were inexhaustible fountains of desire, and I soon ceased to be conscious of my body. Only of the sensation of an arsenal of swords piercing sequentially that most private and unmentionable of apertures. But I was so far outside myself, they might just as well have cut me up and juggled with me, and for all I know they did. They gave me the most comprehensive anatomy lesson a man ever suffered, in which I learned every possible modulation of the male apparatus, and some I would have thought impossible. And then, as if obeying an inaudible whistle, they stopped. The wind and the rain still beat down, but the acrobats were done with their display, though they showed no signs of satiation or weariness, only of conclusion. It was as if they had only been going through a gymnastic exercise. And now they once again toweled themselves, searched for their discarded briefs, and drew them together over the pistons of their loins with the most offensive insouciance. A blubbered wreck, I lay on the coverlet, and I think I was calling for my mother, though it was probably Albertina. After a time, Mohammed came and fed me more coffee, and I think a little arak, and held me in a fairly warm and comforting embrace, murmuring to me in his vile French that I had been initiated, though into what I had no idea. The liquor stung my throat and slowly brought me back to my senses. Mohammed dressed me and then, after a murmured consultation with his colleagues, dug about in a drawer concealed in the lower part of one of the divans. The many coruscating surfaces and the reflections of men were still at last. The men themselves lay on their sides, propped on one elbow, with a childlike brightness in their faces, as if their innocence had been somehow refreshed. I felt a nervous agitation. I longed to be gone, but did not dare move until they ordered me, for fear of unleashing a fresh assault. Mohammed turned to me, holding something coyly concealed behind his back. His G-string throbbed like a sling full of live fish. "C'est pour toi," he said. "Un petit cadeau." He pressed into my hands a little purse of colored cotton and ornamental leather such as they sell to tourists in Port Said. It was decorated with a picture of an Egyptian king listening to his musicians, and the sight almost made me weep to think of ancient Egypt preserved in the jetted amber of the time it had sustained for all of 2,000 years. Then Mohammed threw me gently from the bed, and wrapped me in one of those great, dark, hooded, enveloping, desert Arab cloaks to protect me, he told me, from the weather. And after that, he put me outside the door, sent me into the teeth of the whirlwind. It hurt me dreadfully to walk. The air was full of blown tiles, chimney pots, washing bowls, and dustbins. The wind had seized the town by the throat, and particularly tormented the flimsy tents of the carnival, tossing them about this way and that. The rain came in black, wind-swept pearls, and the river below the city was fearfully swollen, a concourse of angry waters. I walked up the road, away from the inhabited places, as rapidly as the storm and my pain would let me. I had a great need to leave humanity behind for a while. I stumbled over a scrubby field or two and discovered a narrow lane which took me out onto a cliff overhanging the river. Now I had to crawl, for fear the wind would blow me into the gorge. The path took me down onto the face of the cliff itself, and when I saw the mouth of a small cave, I instantly clambered into it, drew my Bedouin coverall snugly about me, and tried as best I could to compose myself a little, though I was in the grip of a terrible reactive shock. Presently, I remembered I still clutched the purse Mohammed had given me, and I opened it. It contained 27 eyes, brown as air and shaped like oblate spheroids. I thought he must have plucked his spare eyes off the mirrors. I was a little light-headed, and I remember I must have spent most of that tempestuous day playing a solitary but elaborate game of marbles with those objects, rolling them across the sandy floor of the cave and laughing with childlike pleasure when they bounced off one another. About noon, I remember, I heard a tremendous roaring crash, and part of my roof came down, swallowing up half a dozen of my toys, which irritated me. But I paid no further attention to the world outside until, one way and another, all the marbles were gone, lost in rat holes or crevices or rolled into the dry undergrowth at the mouth of the cave, where I did not have the patience to retrieve them. When the last one disappeared, I found I was recovered. I felt lightheaded and still severely wounded, but I discovered I was very hungry and thought my master, if he was sober, probably needed me. Besides, the storm had spent its fury, and the rain had ceased almost altogether. So, I came out of my cave to find that most of the track that had taken me to it was obliterated. I scrambled hand over hand up the cliff, while the river gnashed teeth of foam in the ravine below, and all manner of refuse drifted past. I saw there had been a total realignment of the landscape during my oblivion. Everything had a blasted look, and the wind still bit and whipped me as I anxiously made my way back to the town, as if tormenting me for being still alive. And I found the town was there no longer. The town had vanished from the face of the earth, leaving behind it only its sandstone corpse as its own gravestone. The crag on which it had perched was now as bald of habitations as an egg, and smoking in the midst of the turbid river lay a mound of yellow rubble through which, here and there, poked a steeple or a weathercock. The bridge began at its other end and then stopped in midair. A jutting, truncated thrust of masonry hung over the valley, endlessly about to fall, and all signs of the bridge on this side were gone forever, because the town had been plucked from its foundations in the earth and tossed carelessly into the ravenous water. Bathed in the grey, dying light of the afternoon, the ruins were already indistinguishable from the rest of the tumbled rocks in that hellish valley through which the hungry waters roared. When I looked at the river more closely, I saw it was full of corpses, plentiful and insignificant as driftwood. Saints and damned had died together, and only a few ravens of the peaks drifted above the desolation on the wild currents of the air, uttering inconsolable cries. Nothing human moved. The catastrophe was too immense for me to take in all at once. I sank down on a stone and buried my head in my hands. Chapter 5. The Erotic Traveller. At first I thought a landslide must have been the doctor's work, but no logic of any kind, no matter how circuitous, could have justified that disaster. He could have gained no tactical advantages by destroying that forgotten place. Besides, his set of samples had perished completely, and the peep-show was the greatest single weapon in his armory. He would never have destroyed it. So the landslide could only be a simple assertion of the dominance of nature herself, who, in the service only of the meaningless, reintegrated the city with chaos, and then, her business done, casually abandoned it. It was an event of too massive arbitrariness for me to comprehend. But as the rain-washed light fell more and more wistfully on the gigantic tip of sandstone that killed my bearded lady, my reptilian friend, my shooting star, and my blind philosopher, I became most deeply aware of mortality. Even the acrobats of desire could not put themselves together again after this dissolution. No phantom dared float above the desolation, though the water roared with as violent a display of energy as I have ever seen. A stranger would never have guessed that, at this same hour the previous evening, the peak had been crowned with prim streets full of freaks and Puritans. Light died on the rocks. I turned my back on a whole sub-universe that had been wiped out as if with a huge eraser, and on the corpse of yet another of myself, that of the peep-show proprietor's nephew. I stumbled away over the rough fields, vanquished again, now beyond tears. I was in altogether unknown country. After a while I found a rough farmstead built of great blocks of windowless sandstone. But they set a pack of lean, snarling dogs on me, so I could not even beg a crust of bread there. Then a fat white moon rose, and I wandered down a rugged pathway with only my bleached shadow for company. Two pale ghosts against a backdrop of mountains as sharply pointed and unnatural-looking as those outlined by the brusque crayon of a child. I thought that if I wandered far enough, I would certainly reach Hoffman's castle. I was sure I only had to put one foot before the other, indefatigably in the wrong direction, as the old man had told me, and my instincts would guide me there. Although I did not know what I would do when I arrived, except to look for Albertina. So I lurched on drearily until I came to a defile through which ran a narrow road. At the roadside grew a withered tree, and a nightbird perched on one bare branch, emitting a hoarse, rasping rattle, the antithesis of song. I looked along the road in both directions, and all at once hope deserted me entirely. For I did not know which was north and which was south. Suddenly I grew very, very weary. I heard from far away the shriek of a mountain lion and wondered indifferently if I might not be eaten during the night. The notion did not affect me one way or the other. I sat down under the tree and threw my hood up over my head, for a high, thin air sang bitterly in my ears and made my temples throb. I watched the moon move across the white, cloudless sky and saw many unfamiliar stars. I sank into a mindless reverie. I was altogether drained of thought. Presently I heard the clatter of wheels and hoofbeats echoing along the rocks. After some time, a light carriage, a trap of somewhat 18th-century design, appeared upon the road, and I saw two persons share the narrow seat, a tall, black-clad figure with a startling air of authority, and a slender boy who held the reins. The hooves of the black horses struck sparks from the flinty track. The wheels revolved more slowly. The travelers halted. "If you are an Arabian, why do you not sleep?" demanded the older man in the standard speech, which he spoke fluently, though with a slight foreign accent and a very formal intonation. "I fear my dreams," I replied, and looking up met eyes as ghastly as burnt-out coals set in a face so thinly fleshed the bones pushed sharply against the skin. "Then ride with us," he invited. I was willing to go anywhere, so I climbed over the wheel into the space they made for me, and we drove on through the moonlight in silence. My host's profile was as craggy and arrogant as those of the mountains. He was in his late 40s or early 50s. His face was ravaged with pride and bitterness. He wore a black cloak with many layers of capes on the shoulders, and a top hat from which trailers of black crepe depended on the back. He was ready for any funeral, and he carried a cane tipped with a silver ball that looked as if it could kill. His diabolical elegance could not have existed without his terrible emaciation. He wore his dandyism in his very bones, as if it was a color that had slipped out of his essential skeleton to dye his clothes. And he never made a single movement that was not a gaunt but a riveting work of art. I discovered this road must be the low road to the devastated city, for soon it found the river which had so entirely encroached on it, I thought we could go no further. The frightened horses bucked and whickered, but the driver whipped and cursed him. So we went on, though the water swirled about their hocks. When I realized I would see the graveyard of the city again, I moaned involuntarily. "Music," muttered the old man, "music." But I could not tell whether he meant the sound of my pain or that of the gushing swirl of the waters which rang out like a carillon. When this road also vanished under the surface of the water, the driver urged the horses into the river itself. The carriage floated buoyantly, and the horses began to swim. So we went down the river and drove on a moonlit flood over the very heart of the ruins, which were rapidly sinking under the tempestuous waves. The driver exclaimed, "Oh, what an appalling tragedy!" But my host coughed him sharply and snapped, "Lafleur, though I have to warn you again against softness of heart, do as I do, salute nature when she offers us another coup de théâtre." Then he took a flask from his pocket and fed me brandy. "Did you witness it? Did many die?" "The whole population of the town, and also the members of a traveling fair." He sighed with gratification. "Oh, I should have liked to have seen it, and gloried in the Wagnerian clamor of it all, the shrieks, the crash of rending stone, and the little children dashed to smithereens by bounding boulders. What a spectacle! You must know that I am a connoisseur of catastrophe, young man. I witnessed the eruption of Vesuvius when thousands were coffined alive in molten lava. I saw eyes burst and fat run out of roast crackling in Nagasaki, Hiroshima, and Dresden. I dabbled my fingers in the blood beneath the guillotine during the terror. I am a demon for a cataclysm." He flung down his speech as if it were a gauntlet, but I was far too awestruck by his misanthropy to pick it up. At last we saw signs of a road again on the bank, and soon the horses were once more galloping on dry land by the light of too much indifferent moon. "Where are you going?" I asked. He did not so much reply to my question as speak out of the depths of some unknowable reverie of his own. "The journey alone is real, not the landfall. I have no compass to guide me. I set my course by the fitfulness of fortune, and perceive my random signposts only by the inextinguishable flame of my lusts." That silenced me. The wheels of the carriage wound the road on to an invisible spool, and I began to feel the effect of a strange heaviness exerted on me, a perverse and negative fascination exercised by the gaunt aristocrat who sat beside me, though a shudder went through me when I saw his curiously pointed teeth, for they were exactly the fangs with which tradition credits vampires. All the same, he drew me. His quality of being was more dense than that of any man I have ever met, always excepting the minister, of course. Yet apart from his mind, which was a bruising heavyweight, I think what made him so attractive to me was his irony, which withered every word before he spoke it. Everything about him was excessive. Yet he tempered his vulgarity, for he was excessively vulgar in every respect, with a black, tragic humor of which he was only occasionally conscious himself. He was particularly extraordinary in this. He had a passionate conviction he was the only significant personage in the world. He was the emperor of inverted megalomaniacs. But he had subjected his personality to a most rigorous discipline of stylization, so that when he struck postures as lurid as those of a bad actor, no matter how ludicrous they were, still they impelled admiration because of the abstract intensity of their unnaturalism. He had scarcely an element of realism, and yet he was quite real. He could say nothing that was not grandiose. He claimed he lived only to negate the world. It is not the least unusual to assert that he who negates a proposition at the same time secretly affirms it, or at least affirms something. But for myself, I deny to the last shred of my altogether memorable being that my magnificent denial deals more than a simple no. Sometimes my meager and derisive lips seem to me to have been formed by nature, only to spit out the word no, as if it were the ultimate blasphemy. I should like to speak an ultimate blasphemy, and then bask in the security of eternal damnation, but since there is no God, well, there is no damnation either, unfortunately. And hence, alas, no final negation. I am the hideous antithesis in person. I wear to anyone who wants the world of a hereditary count of Lithuania for it, that I am not in the least secretly benignly pregnant with any affirmation of any kind whatsoever. He paused to caress his valet, who, with the submissiveness of the born victim, turned to him a face as livid as putrefaction. After my first shock of horror, I saw this was not a real face, but one quite covered up with white bandages. This pliant valet was almost extinguished by subservience. His very walk was a kind of ambulant cringe. He abased himself obsequiously at all times. He was only a tool of the Count's will. "Is there nothing in the world you do not, to some degree, condemn?" I asked the Count. He was silent for a long time. I thought he had not heard me and repeated my question. I had not yet grown used to the utterly self-centered nature of his discourse. He only answered questions when he thought that he had posed them to himself. But when he eventually spoke, he did so without his customary disdain. The death-defying double somersault of love. The valet made some kind of repressed exclamation at that, probably applause. And the Count somberly rested his chin on the top of his cane, fixing his eyes only on the road before us. When I spoke a little of the war, I met such a blank wall of unresponsiveness, I realized the Count knew nothing at all about it, and the journey continued in the silence of the morgue, until, as we were descending to the plain, the Count spoke again. "I ride the whirlwind of my desires, and I would give this whirlwind, which has driven me to all the four rounded corners of the globe, the emblematic form of a tiger, the most ferocious of beasts, whose pelt yet bears the marks of a flagellation which must have taken place before the dawn of time." It was impossible to converse with him, for he had no interest in anyone but himself, and he offered his companion only a series of monologues of varying lengths, which often apparently contradicted themselves, but always in a spiral line fashion, remained true to his infernal egoism. I never heard another man use the word I so often, but I sensed an exemplary quality in his desperate self-absorption. I had not met anyone who lived with such iron determination since I left the minister. He reminded me of the minister. Yet I am always haunted by a pain I cannot feel, isolated in my invulnerability. Yet I am nostalgic for the homely sensation of pain. A bloody froth blew back in our faces from the mouths of the straining horses. And yet we galloped on without sparing them until we reached a strange place. One of those flamboyant chapels built by the Jesuits, in the fallacious expectation of mass conversions among the Indians and long since abandoned. The moon was dying, but still fitfully illuminated the crumbling facade, and the bushes which grew in the roofless interior, where a startled frog splashed out of the pool of rainwater in the font when we entered with the picnic basket. For the Count wanted to eat breakfast. As if from habit, he pissed on the altar while the valet set out the meal. The Count was always iconoclast, even when the icons were already cast down. Out of the basket came a feast such as I had not eaten since that memorable luncheon with the minister and Albertina. There was a can of truffle goose liver pâté, glasses of game in aspic, a flock of cold roast pheasant, imported cheese whose savorous reek stung the nostrils, a side of smoked salmon from which the valet shaved curling strips, an exotic gravel of various caviars, an insulated box of salad, and another filled with grapes and peaches, while an ice chest contained a dozen bottles of Veuve Clicquot. There was china and sparkling glassware of the finest quality. The cutlery was of solid silver. The boy laid out an incomparable fête champêtre, and we all fell to it with a will. The Count ate very heartily. Indeed, he ate with a blind voracity that demolished the spread so speedily, the valet and I were hard put to it to seize enough to satisfy ourselves, although there was so much. When nothing was left but gnawed bones, dirty plates, peach stones, and empty bottles, the Count sighed, belched, and grasped the valet. His mute hat tumbled to the ground. "Watch me, watch me," he cried, as though, in order to appreciate the effect of his own actions, he had to know that he was seen. But it was far too dark in the ruined church to see anything. I heard the grunts and whimpers of the valet, and the amazing roars which accompanied the Count's lengthy progress towards orgasm. The vault of heaven above is darkened, and all the time frightful cries and atrocious blasphemies issued from the Count's throat. He whinnied like a stallion. He cursed the womb that bore him. And finally, the orgasm struck him like an epilepsy. Ecstasy seemed to annihilate the libertine, and there was a silence broken only by the pathetic whimpering of the valet until, in the velvet and luminous darkness, the Count spoke in a voice drained of all vigor. "I have devoted my life to the humiliation and exaltation of the flesh. I am an artist. My material is the flesh. My medium is destruction, and my inspiration is nature." Now the valet moved painfully about, gathering together the dishes, and it grew light enough to make out the Count's shape as he lolled against the desecrated altar, his head bare. His hair, a coarse and uniform gray, hung down to his shoulders. "I am impregnable because I always exist in a state of dreadful tension. My crisis renders me utterly bestial, and in that state I am infinitely superior to man, as the tiger who preys on man, if he has any sense, is superior. My anguish is the price of my exaltation." I began to wonder if the Count was one of the doctor's agents, and then I thought, no, this man might be the doctor himself, under an assumed identity. The suspicion made me quiver. I can hardly describe to you the man's appalling cerebral lucidity. He was like a corpse, animated only by a demonic intellectual will. When he had rested a little, we climbed back into the carriage and rolled off across the green, spacious countryside, under a vertiginous arc of sky, which began to clear and sparkle. The mountains dwindled behind us. The dew glittered in the budding hedgerows. A lark rose singing. It was a beautiful morning in early spring. The universe itself is not a sufficiently capacious stage on which to mount the grand opera of my passions. From the cradle, I have been a blasphemous libertine, a bloodthirsty debauchee. I travel the world only to discover hitherto unknown methods of treating flesh. When I first left my native Lithuania, I went at once to China, where I apprenticed myself to the imperial executioner, and learned by heart a 12-ton scale of tortures as picturesque as they are vile. When my studies were complete, I tied my tutor to the trunk of a blossoming apricot tree, saw the rosy petals shower down upon his increasing mutilations as, with incredible delicacy and a very sharp knife, I carved out little oysters of his living flesh, the torture known as the slicing, the dreaded Ling Chi. What a terrible sight it was to behold. The apricot tree wept tears of perfumed flowers over him. That was nature's pity. Decorative, but unhelpful. Subsequently, I visited the rest of Asia, where, among other infamies too numerous to mention, I amputated the scarcely perceptible breasts of all the occupants of a geisha house in the exquisitely bell-haunted city of Kyoto. Then I left my crest stamped in wax plugs in all the capacious anuses of the royal eunuchs of the court of Siam. Subsequently, I visited Europe where, as a reward for my villainies, I was condemned to burn at the stake in Spain, to hang by the neck in England, and to break upon the wheel in a singularly inhospitable France, where, sentenced to death in absentia by the judiciary of Provence, my body was executed in effigy in the town square of Aix. I fled to North America, where I knew my barbarities would pass unnoticed, and in Quebec I hired my valet, Lafleur, whose interesting nose was quite caved in under the weight of a hereditary syphilis. Young as he is, his face has already been totally obliterated by the ghastly residue of past pleasures he never tasted personally. Together we traveled to the various states. I gave certain evidence in the trials at Salem, Massachusetts, which condemned 18 perfectly innocent persons to death by pressing. I instigated a rebellion among the slaves on a plantation in Alabama which led to bloody and wholesale retribution. They were all tied to bales of cotton and ignited by ululating clansmen. Then, in a perfumed bordello in New Orleans, I strangled with my legs a mulatto whore, just as she coaxed the incense from my member with a mouth the shape, color, and texture of an overripe plum. But after that, I became the object of the vengeance of her enraged pimp, a block of more than superhuman inhumanity, in whom I sense a twin. And that is why I must not let him catch up with me, for I know too well what he would do to me if he did so. So Lafleur and I drove over the neck of the continent, through deserts that delighted me, since they were far too atrociously barren to sustain life, through jungles altogether envenomed with hatred for the brown maggots of men who dared to try to live in that green, festering meat. and then across those rearing mountains that now lie behind us, than which, even in the steppes of Central Asia, I have seen nothing more arid or inimical. Refreshed, we now travel toward the coast, for I feel stirring within me a strange desire to return to the peaks where I was born, and perhaps I shall try to die there. Unless, that is, the vengeful pimp ensnares me first, which is a horror beyond thought. When noon came, he bought me beer and bread and cheese at an inn. He had not asked a single question of me, or even seemed to ask himself what the stranger was doing in his company. But I realized he regarded me as part of his entourage now. I made a few tentative guesses as to what my role might be. Was I his observer whose eyes, as they watched him, verified his actions? Did his narcissism demand a constant witness? Or had he other plans for me? Would I perhaps figure among his amusements? The masked, unspeaking valet and I formed his little world. If one was his hireling victim, for what purposes was the other hired? But I wonder if his servant had more autonomy than he thought. Something in the texture of the valet's presence hinted he was self-consciously the slave. Occasionally, when he whimpered, he seemed altogether too emphatically degraded. But perhaps he was not yet altogether inured to his position. What would I myself become when I, too, knew what my position was? But though the Count had given me a very detailed autobiography, I still suspected he might really be the doctor, and so I knew I must travel with him, no matter what happened. And then again, he was so remarkable. He seemed to cast a shadow as solid as lead. We drove on through the afternoon, until we came to a lonely crossroads, where suddenly the Count announced, "I know it! I know it! We must turn right!" The signpost which pointed north bore only in faded blue paint the legend, "This way to the house of anonymity," and a lonely path, overgrown with grass and primroses, stretched far away across the faintly burgeoning prairies. There was no sign of any building along its course. The sun had gone in, and the sky was now a leaden gray. Because everywhere was so flat, the sky was swollen and inflated. It occupied so much more space in the world than the earth beneath it, that the sky seemed to smother us under a transparent pillow. The day had not fulfilled the bright promise of the morning. The weather was full of foreboding. But Lafleur turned the horses to the north, though now they were so overdone they ran with sweat and rolled their eyes until the white showed. The Count was very excited. He cried out in mutter to himself as we took the deserted track, and now clouds began to pile heavily in the sky, and a few drops of heavy rain spattered on our faces. "Faster! Faster!" The horses strained their coal-black loins and neighed beneath Lafleur's whip. Then at the side of the road we saw a scarecrow, and although there was nothing in the bare field where it stood for it to protect, it carried a bow and arrow. There was no head inside the hat it wore, only a human skull, and the wind, laden with rain, flapped its ragged jacket miserably around its broomstick bones. Round its neck hung a tattered paper sign which read, "I am perfectly empty. I have forgotten my name. I am perfect, but you are on the right road. Continue." The Count laughed aloud, and we drove on until we came to a door set in a white wall. Here the road stopped short. Lafleur climbed down and rapped upon the door. A grille opened, and we saw a pair of eyes. "Who is it?" asked the woman's voice.
"A hereditary count of Lithuania,"
Lafleur introduced his master.
"Show us the color of your money," said the voice, and the Count gave Lafleur a thick roll of banknotes to show.
The mere sight of it satisfied her. She nodded approvingly and said, Your bill will be presented upon departure, sir.
After some more minutes waiting while the dismal rain sluiced down, the door opened inward with a heavy thunder of bars and chains, and we drove into the courtyard. The door banged to behind us, and the porteress, a fat woman with a puffed, pale face and haggard lips, came to help us down from the carriage. She wore a black dress and a white apron. She did not know how to smile, but she did not wear a mask. None of the servants were masked. Their robes made them sufficiently anonymous. The Count sharply dismissed his valet, who drove the carriage round to the stable. As I glanced after Lafleur, I saw, once he left his master, he sprang up again like a branch which had been tied back and is now released. His slight figure took on a sudden, sprightly decisiveness. Then he was gone. So the Count and I stood in front of the House of Anonymity, whose door was always open to anyone with a fat enough wallet. It was a massive, sprawling edifice in the Gothic style of the late 19th century, that poked innumerable turrets like so many upward-groping tentacles toward the dull, cloudy sky, and was all built in lowering red brick. Every window I could see was tightly shuttered. The portress rang peremptorily for a maid, and a woman who might have been her sister appeared and led us into the house. Through a series of dark, gloomy corridors where our footsteps echoed on flags, until we came to more formal, carpeted quarters, and ascended a winding stair to a little dressing room done up in moist red velvet, like the interior of a womb. She invited us to undress, and while we did so, she took from a cupboard two pairs of black tights made in such a way that, once we put them on, our genitals remained exposed in their entirety, testicles and all. Then she offered us short waistcoats of a soft, suede-like substance, which she assured us was the tanned skin of a young Negro virgin. The Count began to murmur softly with anticipation, and already his prick, which was of monstrous size, stood as resolutely aloft as an illustration of satyriasis in a medical dictionary. Then the maid handed us hood-like masks, which went right over our heads, concealing them, and were attached by buttons to buttonholes in the collars of our waistcoats, so that our heads were changed into featureless, elongated, pinkish, rounded towers. The only indentations on these convex surfaces of pink cardboard were two slits to look through. These masks or hood completed our costumes, which were anesthetic, priapic, and totally obliterated our faces and our self-respect. The garb grossly emphasized our manhoods while utterly denying our humanity. And the costumes were of no time or place. Now we were ready. With our expressions hidden and the most undifferentiated parts of our anatomies exposed, she led us down another stair to a reception room where she bowed, smiled formally, and opened the door for us. "Welcome to the bestial room," she said. And with that, she left us. The insides of the windows had all been painted black, so even if you opened the black velvet curtains, nothing disturbed the artificial night inside them. The walls were covered with a figured brocade of such slumberous purple, the Count murmured. "It is the very color of the blood in a love suicide." Everywhere clinging to the curtains perched on the heavy gold frames of innumerable immense mirrors or crouched on the swags of a marble fireplace were dozens of chattering monkeys smartly dressed like bellboys in bumfries or jackets of braid trimmed crimson plush. And these monkeys were living candelabra. They clutched black candles in their paws. Wedged in, the coiled kinks of their tails were stuck in sockets in the metal circlets they all wore around their heads. When the hot wax dripped onto their fur or into their eyes, they squealed pitifully.